And the haunting and lyrical after the buzzer theme tells you that we're back again. Mike Gross hanging out in the man cave with Gordy. Gordy, how are you, my man?
Outstanding. And yourself?
I'm well. And we have a special guest on the line this week who you may recognize from the Washington Post, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Sporting News, Golf Digest, and lots of one of the great American sports writing careers. And we're going to talk about one of the great American sports writing retirements and post-careers.
yes,
with Dave Kindred. Dave, welcome to After the Buzzer.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Gordy.
Let's talk a little bit about the Lady Potters of Morton, Illinois. Tell us about the history of this basketball program, maybe even beyond your involvement with it. Like, have they been a long time power? What's the story? Who are the coaches? How did this sort of phenomenon happen in this sort of suburb of Peoria? Is that basically right?
It's 10 miles from Peoria, just on the other side of the Illinois River. The history is not sensational.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had, you know, Title IX was 1972.
Yep.
They had teams. Their first really good player was in 1984, a young woman named Cindy Bumgarner, who went on from Morton to Indiana University, became an All-American then. But they were not particularly distinguished until I came here, as a matter of fact. that's being a little wise guy-ish. You know, I came here in 2010. They were good. They had one very good team, been to the Final Four in the state tournament. And then in the first four years I was here, 2010 through 2014, they were good. You know, they won 20 games every year. Then suddenly they got very good.
Yeah.
They had a great D1 commit, D1 positive player.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes in girls high school basketball, is one or two really good players. And if the others know how to play, those really good players can carry them.
Yeah.
They won 4 state championships in 5 years. The 7th year I was here, they were 37-1, lost in the state championship game. So I was lucky. I mean, I didn't come here intending to write about girls' high school basketball. I didn't come here intending to write about anything. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could find a book to write, I would. But a friend had a daughter playing high school basketball. So I went to watch her play one night. And I discovered in this little gym in central Illinois, kind of place where I had been a player a long time ago, and then became a sports writer everywhere. That list of jobs you read off there a minute ago sound like a guy who either couldn't keep a job or just had to keep writing every day somewhere.
A journeyman.
I was the second of those guys. You know, but we came here, friend's daughter played, I went to the game and discovered that, you know, the old war horse syndrome. I could not watch a game without wanting, even if it's girls' high school basketball, without wanting to write about it.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. That totally makes sense to me. It sounds weird to 99% of the population, but I totally get that.
Well, I used to go, when I'd go to a Broadway play, I'd want to go to the dressing rooms later and ask them why they did.
Break it down.
Dick Young, I think, invented locker room quotations, locker room reporting, and I'm very happy for that. It made my life possible. You know, and one of the fathers of the players had a website. I went to him and asked him if I could write for him. He didn't know me, no reason that he should have known me. I was just, as he later said, this old man came out of the stands and wanted to talk to me about writing for me. You know, I resented that implication a little bit.
Really?
You know, but so I've been writing now for 14 years. In fact, Gordy and Mike, both of you should know that I've now been to more Morton High School girls basketball games in 14 years than the coach has been to.
I love this. I sense there's more to that story.
through COVID and a couple of funerals and weddings that he had to go to. Meanwhile, I've missed two games in 14 years.
So has anybody? Well, let's start. What's your relationship with the players like? Do they have any idea about your past career?
No, none of them do. It was 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes of all people called me one time.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I'd often been a talking head on various ESPN bits about athletes and teams, so I figured that's what they wanted. But it turned out that they wanted to do a story about me. And so I said, okay. Well, the girls were quoted in that piece, 13-minute piece. It was great.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago. And the girls were quoted as saying, no, they didn't. I had no idea who he was or what he was doing. He was just a guy coming to games. And that's really the way that I wanted it. Mm-hmm. You know, I just wanted to write about the games. I wrote about them as well as I could write about anything. I treated it as serious basketball. I treated them as serious athletes. And all they knew was that I was writing on their website and on Facebook. And I don't know if you all know teenage girls these days or not. I'm not sure I do, although I talk to a lot of them. I'm not sure they even read Facebook.
Right.
Yeah, Facebook may be too old.
Facebook
for
might be outdated. Yeah, that could be true.
Dave, you forgot about the part where you drove a hard bargain about the compensation for your work.
Well, that first father that ran the website, after a couple of years, he began to realize that I actually knew what I was. I could actually type.
This is so funny.
I said, you know, Dave. His name was Dave. Also, I said, Dave, you know, I'm a professional sports writer. I've been doing this for 30 or 40 or 50 years. Mm. I should be getting something for this.
Mm-hmm.
So he studied me and kind of rethought what I'd been writing and decided how good looking I was. how about a box of Milk Duds every game? And, well, I had grown up eating Milk Duds, so okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
So I've now written about 500,000 words
that's
on the Lady
great.
Potters. I've written more on the Lady Potters than I've written about anything in my life, including Muhammad Ali, and I wrote about him for 50 years.
Right. And this...
So I've eaten a lot of Milk Duds. Particularly good for my figure, but it's something.
So this is all covered in your book, My Home Team, which is subtitled A Sports Writer's Life and the Redemptive Power of Small Town Girls Basketball. Now, central to this book is amid covering your wife suffered a stroke, and she in 2015 she was in a nursing home for 5.5 years, and she ultimately passed in 2021. That being the case, how hard was it to write this book, Dave?
You know, it was. That's why I chose the title "The Redemptive Power of the Basketball," because it not only, you know, it's easy to say it keeps you young,
right?
But it gave me a sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I sat in a row with some old ladies, you know, all of them much younger than me, but they were all grandmothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they called themselves Grandma Rowe.
Mm-hmm.
I sat with them. And so they knew the story. They knew what was happening in my life, and they were all very supportive. One of the players' mothers, in fact, when the stroke happened, I went to the hospital, and one of the players' mothers came to the hospital to see my wife, Cheryl, and to see me.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, you know, there was a game like the next day, I think. This is a week into it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a game the next day, and I said that, I don't know if I should go to the game or not. And the mother said, you must go. And you must go. Her message was, you have to keep living.
Yeah.
You know, you have to find us. You have to let us help you. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the game the next day, and I've been to every one since. Mm-hmm. I alternated between going to the nursing home and to basketball gyms, and it helped me through that. I don't wish that on anybody.
Sure.
And it wasn't a case of how did I write it. It was a case of I could not write it.
Mm, okay.
You know, I had to tell that story. I had to tell the story of my wife, how I met her. I mean, the book begins you know, my home team. The book begins with me, literally the first time I saw my wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was 15 years old. I was 15 years old, too, going to a movie in Atlanta, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw this real pretty girl standing across the street. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who she was. I asked who she was, not her. I was too shy to ask that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I knew who she was, and as things happened, she moved to our school, to Atlanta, Illinois High School, the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to know her well then. And the book ends with me going to the wedding of one of the Lady Potters. Not one of the Lady Potters, the Lady Potter, the daughter of the friend that I went to see, the first Lady Potter that I ever wanted to see,
okay.
Carly Crocker.
Carly Crocker, yeah.
So now, 14 years later, she's getting married. I go to the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, I've been going to a psychologist trying to deal with the loss of my wife. You know, even when she was in the nursing home, she was an invalid who couldn't communicate. So basically, she was gone then.
Yeah.
And the psychologist said, you should just talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife had been dead by then, 2 years. Talk to her. So, I don't know what you guys would do, but I go to the cemetery once in a while and I talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book begins with me seeing her at 15, and it ends with me talking to her.
Wow. Yeah, it's a good, in fact, it's a really moving passage where you write about what you said to her, about being at this wedding and the snow coming down and just, you know, all your thoughts and just the jumble and how talking to her, communicating really fills in those hollow parts that you had for a long time. So it's really moving writing, Dave.
Well, thank you for that. You know, it was, you know, as I said, it brought back happy memories. It brought back the melancholy days of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, I was happy to have done the book, and I hope that people can read it, and it may make some people feel better about their lives and show a way through it. And that's really, you know, a lot of my sports writing friends, you know, we're all sports writers, big time sports writers, get to be cynical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get to be, you know, think that, you know, this is all, you know, what a waste of time of a thinking person's life to be writing about games, kids' games.
Mm-hmm.
The toy department, you know, we've all heard that forever. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not the toy department. You know, and writing about girls' high school basketball, to me, was no different than writing about Michael Jordan's Bulls,
mm-hmm.
you know, or whatever you want to choose, Muhammad Ali. You know, these are 16, 17-year-old, you know, female athletes, but they have the same ambition, they have the same drive, they have the same desires. You know, they want to win, they want to compete as well as anybody ever. You know, the difference is time and strength and all that, but it's the same game, and I treat it seriously. And I'm going to another game tonight. You know, the Lady Potters are 10-3 this year. You know, a good enough year, and they'll be serious about it, and I'll be serious about it.
Dave, tell us about the coach. Who coaches them? What kind of relationship do you have with that person? And what impresses you about them? Because obviously they're doing something really right.
Well, the coach is Bob Becker. He was the coach when I came here. This is his 25th season.
Wow.
He's 53. You know, he was an athlete. He was a basketball player and a baseball player. The first girls' high school basketball game he ever saw was when he coached.
Mm.
You know, like most of us, of a certain age, and I'm certainly older than him, you know, we'd never seen high school girls compete. So it was all new to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a great competitor. His wife was an HR person at a corporation in town. He had two daughters. So he came to understand that while it's basketball, you know, it is girls' basketball. It's not boys. It's not boys who think that if they make one shot out of 15, they're Michael Jordan. You know, he said his girl may make 13 out of 15, and she'll want to be in the gym the next day getting better.
Yeah.
So he's seen that. Yeah. And he likes it. He treats it as serious basketball. He is a serious basketball coach.
Yeah.
He's a grade school PE teacher. Mm-hmm. So he comes over to the high school every day for practice. He still has his practice plans from 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I learned that
about him. You know, they have youth programs in Morton. Morton's a town of 17,000 people.
Yeah.
Youth basketball program called the Heat. So a lot of these girls have been playing basketball since they're in the third and fourth grade.
Yeah.
So they know how to play. You know, they know how to pass, they know how to catch the ball, they know how to shoot it. You know, it's not as if the first girls basketball game I ever saw was in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
We were way out in western Kentucky someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And it was ridiculous. You know, it was a one long jump ball. Mm-hmm. Nobody could hold on to the ball. Nobody could take the ball away from anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, so watching a bad girls basketball game is not fun. But watching the girls who know how to compete, know how to play defense, know how to play mixing. Becker 2 days ago, started the game with a 1-3-1, mm-hmm. went to a 2-3, went to a box and one, mm-hmm. then played a 2-3 matchup zone.
Jeez.
And they all know what they're doing. You know, And what I like about it is a thing that John Wooden once said about girls basketball, that they have to be better with the fundamentals than the boys. You know, guys are big and strong. They play the game in the air. Mm-hmm. The girls play the game on the floor.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
They may take three passes to get the ball where they can score, mm-hmm. instead of a showboat just doing a spin move and jumping over somebody.
There you go.
So it's a different game.
Mm-hmm.
I would really like to talk a little bit with you, Dave, about Muhammad Ali, because he was, I don't know, I have two sons who literally don't know what a first down is. I mean, they're completely out of sports, but they found Muhammad Ali to be an incredibly compelling, interesting, they were fans of Muhammad Ali. One of the most interesting people in American history. Tell us a little bit about your history with him, dealing with him, writing about him.
Well, as I said, I wrote about him literally for 50 years. Mm. And I did a book, a dual biography of Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell. Everyone remembers Ali. Not everyone. You people, you know, Mike and
we do, yeah.
Morty will remember Cosell. Mm. They were one of a kind, both of them.
Yep.
And I was able to do the book. Well, my agent didn't think a book about Ali would sell. I thought it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, you know, okay.
At a time when he had not been restored
right.
to the sainthood that he enjoys now. I've said often that once he was the most reviled athlete in America, then he became the most revered athlete in America.
Yep.
So, and that's the narrative of the book that I did called Sound and Fury.
Mm-hmm.
I met Ali when he was 24. I was 25.
Hmm.
I was a new kid in Louisville, Kentucky, on the Courier Journal. One day, there's nobody. I'm sitting in the office with my son, who then is 3 years old. I'm Mr. Mom, babysitting. Boss comes by and says, "Clay's in town. Go find him." the newspaper still called him Cassius Clay. He was already Muhammad Ali by then. He was the world champion.
Wow.
He had beaten Liston twice. This was 1966. So the newspaper, though, still called him Cassius Clay.
Mm.
So I know nothing about Louisville. I'd been there for like 2 months. Clay's in town. Go find him. So I walked about two blocks to an artist gallery. His father considered himself an artist, Cassius Marcellus Clay Sr.
Mm-hmm.
He at least told me where I could find Cassius. I spent all day with Cassius Clay, riding around in his car all day, my son and I, wrote a story about it, and that was, again, as I said, October of 1966, and I wrote about him every year until he died after that.
Wow.
I went to 17 of his championship fights, 17 of his fights, 10 of them championship fights. The story that I begin the book with is in Las Vegas once, in his hotel suite. I forget what fight it was, but it's always crowded because Ali, unlike most celebrities, wanted people around him all at all times.
Mm-hmm.
So the suite is crowded. I'm standing out in the center hall. He's in bed in a side room and sees me and says, "Louisville, come in here." I don't know if he ever knew my name or not. He knew I was his Louisville reporter.
Right.
"Louisville, come in here." So I go in there and there's people in there. I can't hear him. He can't hear me. He raises up the corner of the sheet and says, "Get in." Well, I did. And one of us had on clothes. I do this interview of him. We pull the sheets up over our heads like we're kids hiding from our parents. And I'm asking him about his entourage. He takes my notebook and writes their names down and how much he's paying them every week.
Oh, my gosh.
And we talk for a little more about the plan. And then I say, "Okay, thanks." And I leave. And so that was not the beginning of our relationship, but it was certainly an indication that the relationship had deepened.
Yes, that's a safe statement.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard you tell that story before, and it always amazes me that that happened.
So, Dave, why were you naked? Dave, why were you naked?
You noticed that, huh?
Yeah.
As I've said, at that time I was too young to even write that story for the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sure how that would go over with the readers in Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
So I didn't write that story until like 30 years later for the book that I did.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to imagine that happening, but almost everything that happened around Muhammad Ali was impossible to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because anything could happen at all times. He was the most accessible of athletes, of celebrities ever. He wanted people around and he would walk the street. He'd stop on a street corner just to see how many people would show up in the next 10 minutes. You know, there were always hundreds of people.
That's crazy.
And my take on him always, and the take that I cite in the book consistently and have forever, is that he was just a sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a sweetheart.
Yeah.
You know, the Ali that we like today was always the Ali.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was kind of a mesmerized, kind of a voodoo hold by the black Muslims in the late 60s and early 70s. Changed when the leader of the black Muslims, Elijah Muhammad, died. After that, when Elijah Muhammad was gone, the Islam sect, black Muslim sect of Islam, changed, became a different kind of feel to them.
Yeah.
Ali then was much more the Ali that we came to revere after that.
Hmm.
Certainly the Ali that stood in Atlanta and lit the torch was a different Ali than the one who...
Yeah.
Said, "I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong."
Yeah, no question. No question. Yeah.
Whole different era. I mean, if an Ali came along today, he'd have like a team of publicists to buffer him, right? It's a whole different era that's probably difficult for people to even fathom in this day and age, would you say?
I started to say before, even in his prime,
mm-hmm.
he well could have had an entourage of any sort he wanted.
Right.
He didn't need it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want it. He didn't need protection. He didn't need to be protected from people. He wanted people around him at all times. He was the one and only.
Mm-hmm.
There have been people who have tried to be Ali,
right.
who have tried to be that kind of showman.
Yeah.
And that's what I said about Cosell. There, you know, you all are familiar with TV and radio announcers who want to be Howard Cosell.
Right.
They want to be that voice.
Mm-hmm.
There was only one Cosell. The one and only. Nobody could ever repeat him. Nobody could ever repeat Ali.
Right. Well, how was Cosell as far as the book was concerned? Did you have, what were your dealings like with him?
I was one of the few newspaper men that Cosell respected.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he ever admired me, but he at least respected me because I stood up to him. I didn't let him bully me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I agreed. We were on a political plane mostly the same, you mm-hmm. know, a liberal leftist wing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always on Cosell's side in I'd say 90% of his arguments with society.
Mm-hmm.
So I got along with him very well. I knew him for 19 years. I knew Ali, of course, for 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and but I knew them both well. I spent a lot of time with Cosell in his apartment in New York. You know, his wife was the only person who could really speak to him in common terms. She was a darling. You know, I got to know her. Mm-hmm. So I consider it, you know, the high points of my career as a journalist certainly was time with Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Cosell, in my mind, as a journalist, I thought he was a great journalist too.
Mm-hmm.
He asked all the right questions. He was unafraid. You know, he went where no one else would go, and I had great respect for him. So I count those two as a major characters in my life as a journalist.
Mm. Dave, another sport that you've written a lot about is golf, and it just occurs to me I'd like to know what you think of what's happened in the last couple of years in golf with this LIV Tour and the Saudi money coming into it, which I think, in my mind, is a disastrous thing, but what do you think?
Well, disastrous is, or catastrophic. Catastrophic.
Catastrophic is good. Yeah.
I'll call you disastrous and raise you a true syllable.
Yeah, you win. You win the pot.
Catastrophic. I think I don't know. I mean, first of all, I don't think any golfer ever is worth the money that some of these people are getting for just showing up.
Yeah, that's the key, just showing up.
You know, appearance money has always been there, and some people have deserved it. Certainly Tiger did. Tiger brought people to the game the same way as Arnold Palmer had done it. You know, so they bring people to the game. But golf is not a particularly exciting game. You know, it's played out over 150 acres. Nobody can see what's happening.
Yeah.
When it's over, it's a better TV show than it is showing up. So the whole Saudi thing, the Saudi money is dirty. It's just...
No, beyond that.
It just has an ugly feel to it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really sorry that Jon Rahm finally gave in and said, okay, you hit a number that I like.
Yeah.
You know, $300 million or something just for signing up.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any difference if he plays well or not. And he will. And I hope that at some point in time, some kind of common sense sanity prevails and it goes back to a single tour with some kind of economics that is not just profane.
I hear you. Now, here's a happier subject. You worked for, among the many places we mentioned where you worked, we did not mention the National. Which I loved.
Yeah, I loved it. But you just couldn't find it.
I subscribed to it. I got it home delivered. Anyway.
I was
a called of one. I somehow got the National delivered.
I still have, I think, their last copy of it. I still have it. But
I have a couple copies of it. Anyway, that was a strange episode in American journalism. And I thought it was a wonderful thing. What did you think it was?
Well, I did not think it was strange. I thought it was futuristic, and that's the problem.
Yeah,
it was
kind of was
ahead of its time. Everything that the internet does now, that's what the National wanted to do in print.
Yep.
You know, it was impossible to do it in print.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we discovered that very quickly. I signed up because I thought it was a great adventure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in Atlanta at the time, and I got a 5-year contract because I wasn't going anywhere without that. And it lasted a year and a half.
Mm.
You know, although the people who gave me the contract continued to pay for 3.5 years,
did they?
So that was good. But I think it was a great project. It was fun. We had people who were giants in the business on the newspaper.
That's for sure.
The technology was not ready. I mean, the first night we printed, we couldn't print in Detroit. You know, there were like 5 or 6 or 7 cities at the time where we were trying to put out a newspaper, but could not get it done in Detroit because it was raining in Detroit.
Oh, my gosh.
And the satellite transmissions weren't working. you know, like on your TV when it goes out because the satellite can't get the message through the clouds. We didn't know how to deal with that. You know, if it, what ESPN did, I can't think of a better example, but what the internet does now is what the National was trying to do, but didn't have the technology, or didn't spend the time to do it.
I wanted to ask you another question about your book, and this is something you addressed within the book, where you said that some of your friends in the business have said, well, isn't this beneath you to cover girls basketball? And I wonder if you could just share what your response has been to them.
Well, one of my friends, a great friend, John Feinstein, you know, has said that it'd be a kindred writing about girls high school basketball is like Barack Obama leaving the presidency to join a school board in Chicago.
Well, he's trying to be nice.
I appreciate that sentiment. Yeah. But what I tell them is that I think of it, as I tried to say earlier, to me it's as pure competition as there is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you've been around big-time athletics for a long time, maybe not even a long time, but certainly a long time for me, you begin to realize that the fun of it, the purity of it, is gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw a thing today that said the second-string quarterback at Texas, the University of Texas, who happens to be named something Manning.
Yeah.
Arch.
This year made over $3 million on NIL, whereas the starting quarterback, perhaps the MVP in the NFL this year, Brock Purdy, is making $837,000
wow.
from the San Francisco 49ers.
Wow.
Something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Manning is going to be good. He just happens to be second string now because he's a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, it's all out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
And so at my age, you know, it's, and at my point in life, I don't have any interest in pursuing the NCAA or whatever it used to be. I pursued it long enough, you know, 40 years ago. I thought the athletes were being taken advantage of then. Now it's gone too far the other way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's fun. I just tell them that it's fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What we all got into the business for were the games.
Yeah.
I mean, we all played in those little gyms on little fields, cornfields, pastures, whatever. We all started there somewhere, and that's where I've wound up. And I just, you know, I write about it as well as I can. I have as much fun as I can. And I eat as many milk jugs as I can.
And you've said that you have no plans to retire. The statement you've used in other interviews is writers write, and that's what you're going to continue to do, and as long as you can. Correct.
There's no reason to quit.
Right.
No reason to quit. You know, you get to do it's fun. You know, to me, it's creating something every night.
Mm-hmm.
I try to go to a game and see something I've never seen before. If you're paying attention. So I tell students in schools, or when it, you know, what do? I said, just pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Pay attention, and then pay attention. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see something every night, every game, everywhere that you've never seen before. Or, you know, if you're old like me, you've forgotten you saw it. I enjoy that every night. I'm always looking for something new. And then you get to write about it, and you're right. Writer's right.
There you go. Hey, Dave, it's been great.
Yeah, I love that you're doing this, and I know you have a game to cover tonight, so.
Yeah.
Crank it up.
We appreciate the time very much.
I'm sorry?
Well, I said we appreciate the time very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun. You know, I, obviously, as you can tell, I like to talk about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's I've had a great life, a charmed life. I wanted to be Red Smith. I wanted to be a big-time sports writer. I got to do that. And now I'm having fun just watching great athletes compete.
There you go.
God love
you.
Well, best to you, Dave, and thanks so much.
All right. Write a good one. Write the heck out of this one tonight, Dave.
I will do that. I guarantee it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Be well. Take care. Dave Kindred, the legendary one.
That was really cool. That was fun.
I love that he's doing this.
I've been doing. We're roughly contemporaries. I've been doing this for 40 years.
Right.
I personally am worn out for high school sports.
Right.
I have had the opposite thing, and maybe it's because I've covered so much more of it as a percentage of my total work compared to him. But you know, for anybody to think, well, like, this is beneath him, well, why?
No.
I mean, I don't really understand that. But and I'm sure Feinstein was just kind of making a joke about you know, how Kindred is this elite guy, which he certainly is. But yeah, it's pretty cool.
I mean, I know when I remember the 60 Minutes piece, which John Wertheim.
Yeah, I watched it too.
A great writer in his own right, and I remember looking at that and saying, well, why couldn't I do that? I'm retired. why couldn't I, with whatever, you know, go follow F&M for a season or follow E-Town or whatever or whomever.
Well, you could do that.
Right. So it just struck me as a really refreshing thing that he's doing, that, for Milk Duds. And as we said, he started out, he was writing for the team's website, and then the team's website is no longer being updated because, as Dave told me earlier today, they run out of dads to run it. So Dave is writing these pieces for Facebook. It's a shame that the website isn't active, because it is a really nice website. It's really well made. It was well maintained, and it was pretty professionally done. So it's a shame that it's no longer being updated. But
now here, you know, most people who cover high school sports get a lot of grief from parents. I wonder if that's an issue for him. It probably isn't.
Yeah.
He's only focused on one team.
Right.
The team is very successful. I'm sure it's very minimal, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's some...
Why do you cover them? I think at this point, it's like, I'm sure he just shrugs it off. I'm sure he's got grief.
And he's 82 years old?
Correct.
Talk about a veteran guy.
I just think it's wonderful that he's doing this. I really do. And the writing, the book is just exceptional. I mean, we're a couple of days away from Christmas. If you know a sports fan, or really, it doesn't even need to be a sports fan, because I don't think it's really a sports book as much as it is just a human book.
And again, it's My Home Team is the name of the book, and the writer is Dave Kindred, who certainly is a household name with us, but may not be with everybody.
I highly recommend the book.
He's a big time guy.
It's a wonderful. He's always been a wonderful writer. He writes, it's not easy, but it reads easy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's that
kind of reading that is easy to read, which doesn't mean it was easy to write.
Correct.
Yeah.
So we're really grateful to have Dave on, because he's really one of the most highly decorated sports writers to ever do it. So.
Yeah, we could have gone into all the halls of fame, but I thought that was almost embarrassing. Trust us, he's in all kind of halls of fame.
Yes, that would have been 15 minutes in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah. So. One of those Gilbert Gottfried to drink. If you've ever listened to his podcast. Anyway.
So we had a little bit of Penn State news this week. Tom Allen introduced as their new DC. You have been writing about that this week. What is your takeaway from all of this?
A couple things. Franklin is able to make these hires really quickly, which I think speaks to the fact that he always talks about, well, I have alignment now with the athletic director and the administration, where he can go out and throw money at a guy, because they must have thrown some money at this guy. He had a $15 million buyout from when he got fired as the head coach in Indiana. This is the second time in a row now that they've hired a defensive coordinator who just got fired as a Power 5 head coach. So I think that speaks to where Franklin is in the industry, maybe a little bit.
I think so.
Right? Doesn't that make sense?
Probably also his powers of persuasion.
Oh, yeah.
Because we've seen him, we've heard him, we know that this guy can really make a pitch.
He's a sales guy. He is a sales guy, and that shows up, obviously, in recruiting, which kind of came to a head yesterday with National Signing Day. But Allen, our buddy Dave wrote a nice column about Allen and what he thinks of this hire. And one of the things he mentioned, which I didn't even really realize, is that Allen is very well connected in Florida.
Oh.
And he recruited the other places he's been, he's recruited Florida.
That's a good place to recruit.
and that is a good place to recruit. And I think It almost feels to me like Franklin has decided we're probably not getting California. Mm-hmm. We're probably not getting Texas. Mm-hmm. We're probably not getting maybe like Georgia, the real mm-hmm. hotbeds of the SEC. But Florida, mm-hmm. we can still get Florida. That's... And Juwan Sider is the running backs coach, is another guy who's very connected in Florida. I think they're still plugging in there. Now, they only got one guy from Florida in this mm-hmm. in the group that signed yesterday. But that may be something to think about mm-hmm. going forward.
Yeah, the thing that jumped out to me about the recruiting class is they got another quarterback from Ohio yeah. as Drew Allery's, and you made the comparison that their career arcs have kind of been the same.
Kind of late bloomers, right. guys that Penn State was interested in before really anybody else was, mm-hmm. and then they really took off. I mean, he was one of these Elite 11 guys, mm-hmm. this Grunkenmeyer kid who just signed, Ethan Grunkenmeyer. He goes to Olentangy High School, which is on the banks of the Olentangy.
Oh, really?
So you figure he's kind of in the shadow of Ohio Stadium, but Penn State got him. And he has the same quarterback guru, personal coach that Aller does. It's Brad Mandler, guy who I've talked, it's kind of become a source for me. I've talked to him a number of times. He's an interesting guy who mm-hmm. played the position in college and mm-hmm. has become really an in-demand quarterback. He has his own building now. He has it looks kind of like Haluba. Uh-huh. His business is booming, and maybe Penn State is benefiting from that a little bit. I think Grunkenmeyer is seen as the post-Aller guy.
Yeah, it seems so. I'm sure he will be called Grunk if that comes
to pass.
The
Grunk. The Grunkorama.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the banks of the Olentangy. Keith Jackson's name came up this week on Twitter, or whatever we're calling it these days, because Penn State's 82 championship team was ranked 19th greatest team.
Whatever.
And Todd Blackledge commented on that, and he included the clip of him throwing that famous touchdown pass to Greg Garrity, which was narrated by Keith Jackson, where he goes, "He's going for the bundle." And I interviewed Todd, and he mentioned that. And then a couple years later, he was working with Keith, which is kind of interesting to me too. But the call is just perfect. And Keith is to me, if any announcer has ever been synonymous with a sport, it is him.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure there's other people I'm not remembering, but.
There's nobody who surpasses him in that.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree.
There's nobody who surpasses him in that.
Yeah, and that call in particular is perfect.
Going for that bundle.
Touchdown.
Nice.
And the other call there are many, but the one where Cordell Stewart threw that touchdown pass to Michael Westbrook against Michigan.
Yeah.
I mean, Keith, you thought he was going to jump out of the booth.
Keith could get a little excited.
But yeah, he was. Somebody said once that no matter who was playing, it would always sound like Alabama was playing Oklahoma. Even if it was Notre Dame and Penn State.
He could sell it, man.
But yeah.
He could paint a picture.
So he was right. He's as great an association between him and college football as any announcer in any sport.
Yeah,
for sure.
I would agree.
So the other thing we wanted to talk about was last night Joel Embiid dropped 51 points on Chris Finch's Minnesota Timberwolves, who came in as the number one defensive team in the NBA.
And with the best record in the
NBA. Yes, the best record in the NBA, and walked out a smoking ruin after Embiid and Tyrese Maxey combined for 86. That's a night.
That's impressive.
I mean, the stuff that they do, the actions, the two-man actions that they run, it's really hard to guard.
Yeah.
Really hard to guard.
Yeah, it is. And Nick Nurse, I think, gets some credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
Ought to get some credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
But they are hard to deal with. And again, like you said, Minnesota has become a great defensive team.
Mm-hmm.
But it just shows you how hard Embiid is to deal with. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, we're talking about, if we're just talking about scoring.
Right.
I mean, he's one of the all-time greats already. I think you can say that. He's so hard to stop. He gets 40 just kind of ambling along. And I'm not saying he's not playing hard,
sure.
but he's so skilled and so big.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
I mean, you have to honor the fact that he can muscle his way around you. And that being the case, he'll catch the ball 12 feet away and jab step you, and then just casually make that shot again and again and again.
It almost looks like a shoot around. It's so routine that we almost, I think it almost is underrated a little bit because it's so routine. He's real. I mean, what is he averaging? 34 now.
Yeah, he's the league. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting to me a couple things because you know Minnesota, as we said, came in at the top defensive team in the league, and 22 seconds into the game, Rudy Gobert, who's playing really well and is obviously a three-time defensive player there, he gets a foul.
Yep.
By the end of the first, he has two fouls. The other two primary bigs for Minnesota have two fouls. So you kind of knew how this game was going to unfold, that they weren't going to have their normal rotations.
Yeah.
And it was going to be really hard for them to deal with Embiid the rest of the... And sure enough, he had 31 in the second half, and he was just going... At one point... They had Kyle Anderson on him, who's basically a small forward, and so Embiid just wheeled around him and threw down this hellacious dunk, and it was just, you kind of knew how the game was going to unfold.
Now, didn't Maxey have most of his points late?
Yeah, I forget. He had 20 in the first half also, and he had 15.
Oh, so then he didn't.
Yeah,
okay.
But he was certainly a factor. I mean, he was... I mean, he's hard to stay in front of. His confidence is really high right now.
They're both really hard. They're both incredibly hard to guard. And when somebody is quick enough, it's almost like you see when you watch a running back and he's turning the corner against him.
Yeah,
it's a good comparison. Think, well, this guy is really, and that's how he is. I mean, he's blowing around NBA guards.
Yeah.
It's freaky.
He's fearless, and he plays with a lot of energy. It's really interesting to watch.
And he's become a really, really skilled player. Yeah. I don't mean to suggest that it's just crazy athleticism.
No.
It's a lot more than that.
He can really shoot, too. It's a really, speaking of hard to guard. Now, this is interesting to me. Now, Chris Finch, the Minnesota coach, the former FNM player, and Nick Nurse, the Sixers coach, they have kind of like parallel career lines. They both coached against each other in England. They coached against each other in the G League, and now, of course, the NBA. And in fact, Finch told me that when he was still in Europe and Nurse was in the G League, Nurse encouraged him to come to the G League just because he thought it would be a great career move, you know, get yourself established.
Okay.
And Finch, you know, was actually hesitant. The way he put it, he was making good money overseas.
Mm.
He coached in England, Germany, Belgium, but he decided to make the jump, and they were both eventually kind of in the Houston organization. In fact, Chris coached the Rio Grande Valley Vipers, and then Nurse succeeded him as the coach there when Chris went up and became an assistant for the Rockets. And then Nurse went up to Toronto. Eventually, Chris was his assistant in Toronto.
Yeah, I thought at one point he was Nurse's assistant.
And in fact, for the British Olympic team, Chris was the head coach and Nurse was his assistant over there in the 2012.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So they have a long association.
Oh, man. You are fitting it together here.
Yeah, so it's really kind of interesting. And I'm planning to write this. I talked to both of them about this whole thing. But when they're in Toronto, Chris said, you know, he had this reputation as an offensive coach. He goes to Toronto and he said, well, Nick, it was like taking a master class in defense. So it's kind of interesting now. Chris has the best defensive team, and Nurse has this juggernaut offensive team. You know, I mean, now granted, their schedule has been a little soft to date, the Sixers, but I mean, you got to be impressed by what they're doing. I mean, all the clouds are gone from there's no Simmons stuff, there's no Harden stuff, there's nobody with burner accounts that we know of.
I thought you were going to launch in a song there.
Yeah.
Right? All the clouds are gone.
Yeah, exactly.
A little poetic.
Yeah. Nice. Give me a bouncy C.
A bouncy C.
But it really is a refreshing look at this team. I mean, I would think they would kind of flesh out the roster a little more, but they have a lot of guys they can run out there.
They do. They have some depth, and they have Nicholas Batum, who I enjoy saying his name, so that's good. And, you know, they're pretty good defensively. I think they still have some room defensively. And certainly, I guarantee you Nick Nurse thinks that.
Yeah.
Because he's a defensive guy, as you said. And I don't think they're where they want to be in that regard. But they might get there. They might get there.
They might have to, given they're going to have to go through Boston or Milwaukee to get to the finals. I mean, that's pretty clear right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, Miami's going to be in the mix somewhere. They play Miami on Christmas
Day
down
there. Yeah, that's coming up.
So, you know they're going to be a hard out. You know that. But so they're going to have to take it up another notch. And, you know, they haven't, you know, it's been often said that, you know, they haven't been past the second round since 2001. Yeah, that's a long time.
That's a long time. Yeah,
so
that's a long time.
They're going to have to maximize. So, but I like where they are, and I think that this isn't the finished product in a lot of ways. I think the roster will change, and I think the abilities in different aspects is going to have to change.
Yeah, they're close, and they're close, and there's still some room to get better. Yeah. So it's It is, and they're fun to watch.
They really
right
are.
Right now, they're fun to watch. That's the other
because
thing.
It's like the two-man stuff they run with Maxi and Embiid. I mean, there's all kinds of room to operate, and it's like you whatever choice you make is a bad one, really.
It's, yeah.
As a defense.
It seems less ponderous than it was with other guards and the pick-and-roll thing with Embiid. I like what they're doing.
I really like their team, so it bears watching.
But all right, big guy.
I think we're at the end of our journey, all Michael.
Right, we've done it again. Thanks very much to Dave Kindred.
Indeed.
Hey, happy holidays, everybody. Yeah. It's coming up, and we probably won't talk for a while. I will be in Atlanta a week from now.
Indeed.
With the Knits. So. But we'll be back in January with more fun stuff.
I think so, too. Yeah, that was great today. It was always fun to talk to somebody of that caliber.
And then
enthusiasm, which he has maintained for all this time.
We get good guests on this show.
Thank goodness. No, I'm kidding.
Well said. All right, that's it, gang. We'll talk to you again soon. He's Gordy. I'm Mike. See ya.